This teaching, given by Mike Sayer, is entitled George Lucas's Ultimate Question. It is intended as an aid to effective use of Mike's evangelistic tracts. This teaching covers the background to the tract, George Lucas's Ultimate Question. These tracts, and a catalogue of other tapes and tracts, are available from Pilgrim Tapes, Box 296, Sunland, California, 91040.
Now, for the session, we're going to be looking at the tract, George Lucas's Ultimate Question. I think I'm going to retitle the tract. I've run into too many people who don't even know who George Lucas is. It's dated my tract a bit, and so I'll probably have to call it something else. George Lucas is the man of Star Wars fame, producer of Star Wars movies. George Lucas was 6 years old. He asked the ultimate question almost everyone asks at one time or another, and this quote is, "It's centered on God. What is God? But more than that, what is reality? What is it?" It's as if you reach a point and suddenly you say, "Wait a second, what is the world? What are we? What am I? How do I function in this, and what's going on here?" That's from Skywalking. That's a biography on George Lucas by Dale Pollack from Ballantine Books. Okay, so the question here basically is, what could God be like? When you're witnessing to people, it is important to find out what kind of God they believe in, because where they start their thinking about God is where they start their thinking in their philosophy. There is a reason why people say things like, well, I believe in reincarnation. A guy said that to me one time, and I said, well, the reason you believe in reincarnation is because you have a particular view of God and of the universe, and that's why you believe in reincarnation. And he said, oh, you're going to tell me what my view of the universe is and my view of God? And I said, yes, I will. And he said, well, what is it? And so I gave him a basic description of Eastern concept of God, an infinite impersonal force that's behind everything, basic monism. And he said, and I described his view of the universe. And he said, yes, that's basically it. Now, how did you know that? I said, well, it's my business to know things like that. I'm a missionary. Okay, and so that guy eventually got saved too. And I took his book on Eastern religions that he was following from his guru, and I said, see here at the beginning of this book, it says there's no difference between good and evil because there aren't any absolutes. And he said, yeah. And I said, look at this chapter of the book. It says that you're supposed to develop good karma rather than bad karma. If there's no difference between good and evil, what's the difference between good karma and bad karma? And he looked at both of them and said, that is inconsistent, isn't it? And I said, yes, it certainly is. And I said, you know, I think you need to find yourself a more consistent religion. Which, after we witnessed to him for a few days, he found a more consistent religion. Okay, so when you're talking with somebody, though, you have to deal with the issue of whether or not there is a God. But then after you've discussed that, which you can get my tapes on 10 Things Every Thinking Atheist Ought to Know, which is based on one of my tracts. You get my tract and read it if you want. But when you've dealt with that, say a little advertisement here, my wife will be proud of me. Okay, she's the head of the tape department, Carol. Okay. Then once you've dealt with that, the issue of whether or not there is a God, you've dealt with the issue of atheism and the inconsistency, the idea of atheism, then you need to talk about what God could be like. And in here you have a little chart, but I want to look at the three major categories of what God could be like. And you can use this when you're witnessing. Okay, God could be finite. This is the bottom of the first page here. God could be finite, or God could be infinite. All right? God could be material, matter and energy, or God could be immaterial, or spirit. God could be impersonal, not having intellect, emotions, and will, or personal, having intellect, emotions, and will. And if you lay that out as a chart, you get the little chart that I have in the middle of the track there. And that is, you have the idea that God, if God is, God could be finite or infinite. Okay, and then under that, you've got two categories. God could be material or immaterial. Immaterial, spiritual, yeah, spirit. It's defined in there in the track. Okay, now you have four. Notice you now have four categories. That is, God could be finite and material, or finite and immaterial, infinite and material, or infinite and immaterial. And under each of those, you have two major categories. And that is, God could be impersonal or personal, impersonal or personal, all the way across. Now, if you want to follow this with your mind, that gives you 8 categories that God could be like, logically. And it goes like this. God could be finite and material and impersonal. Finite, material, and personal. Finite, immaterial, and impersonal. Finite, immaterial, and personal. Infinite, material, and impersonal. Infinite, material, and personal. Infinite, immaterial, and impersonal. Infinite, immaterial, and personal. So you have 8 different possible categories, logically speaking. And you can use this when you're talking to people to say, look, there are only certain categories of existence that God could be. He can only be a certain number of ways. And he could either be finite or infinite. He can be material or immaterial, that is, matter or spirit. Or he can be impersonal or personal. And you put all those together and you get 8 you get 8 possibilities, and you can show the person that. And so what we're going to do is think some of these things through and take a look at them, and then we'll talk about how to use this chart in talking with people about the nature of God. God could be, now you don't have to draw the chart for the person, but you at least need to be able, when you're talking with the person, to ask them the proper questions, see? You only have to ask them 3 questions to find out what kind of God they believe in. Because out of all these 8, it all divides into 3 categories. Right? Say a person, you're witnessing to a person, you say, do you believe God is finite or infinite? And you say, oh, I believe God is infinite. Okay? Okay, do you believe God is personal or impersonal? Right? Oh, I think God is impersonal. Well, do you think God is material or immaterial? Oh, God is immaterial. You say, God is not material. What have they just told you? I believe in this. They've just told you that they're a Hindu or a Buddhist or whatever. Okay? And so you only have to ask those 3 questions. What do you believe God is like? Do you believe he's this, this, or this? And they've told you then what kind of God they believe in. All right? So then, if God could be finite, material, right? Matter and energy rather than spirit, and impersonal. You see there on your little chart, you have things like materialism, idolatry, things, money, any of those things there, the person could be believing in. Then we have the finite and material and personal. Okay, that would be any kind of person, human being, that is worshipped as God. The Emperor of Japan, Haile Selassie, well, I mean, it used to be. Emperor of Japan, Haile Selassie, rock stars, and so forth. Okay, you got different people. And you could fit, in some cases, you might be able to fit Stalin in there or Lenin, although most of the time that would fit into the next category, which is a philosophy that is worshipped as God. Okay, so you have finite, immaterial, that is, not material, but spirit, rather. Finite, material, and immaterial, and impersonal. This would be any kind of philosophy. You've got the Greek fates. Because it's hard to tell if we've got the Greek fates behind the gods or the gods behind the fates. It's a little difficult to tell sometimes who's running what in Greek philosophy. But you've got the Greek fates are different philosophies, different concepts. And then you've got the finite, immaterial, and personal. Finite, immaterial, and personal, which gives you the Greek gods, demons, ancestor worship, your idolatry, which is Paul the Apostle said behind every idol there's a demon, and it's not that the people are actually worshiping the idol, but rather the demon that is behind that. You can find that in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 18 and following. Okay, and so finite, immaterial, and personal would be, as I said, your ancestor worship, worship of demons, and so forth. Okay, that is finite, limited, immaterial, spirit, a limited spiritual being that has personality. That's why it's demons. Do you understand what's going on here? You see what's happening? Okay, and then you have the other side of the chart, which is the infinite side, infinite, material, and impersonal. This is where your naturalism basically falls in. People are looking at the universe, the matter and energy that exists in the universe, as being God. Infinite, that is, the universe would be infinite, it'd be material, and impersonal, not having intellect, emotions, and will. Then infinite, material, and personal, the only doctrine I know of that's following that right now is Mormonism. And I checked this out with a professor of continuing Mormon education and called him on the phone and said, can I ask you some questions? I've been calling all different kinds of churches and wards and stakes and everything else trying to find out somebody that can talk to me about this. So he said, well, yeah, I'd be glad to talk with you. He's a professor of continuing education, Mormon education, that's associated with Northridge University. Okay. And so we talked about that for about an hour, hour and a half, and I presented to him over the phone this chart, and I think he was writing it down on the other end. And I said, would you agree with the idea? I said, I think that Mormonism fits in here. I said, would you agree with that? And he said, yes, we would. He said, we believe God is material, although the material or the substance that God is made out of is different from the common garden variety matter and energy, but it's still material rather than immaterial, rather than spirit. And so he said, God is material. And I said, do you actually view God as, in essence, a six-foot man that's living on a planet near the star Kolob? And he said, yes, we do. And so, populating the universe with spirit children that need to be born as human beings so that they can become God, so that they can populate their own universe and so forth. He said, yes, that's basically what we believe. Okay, which is, no, it's what they believe. Although a lot of Mormons don't even know that. Okay, so it's infinite, material, and personal. And basically, the only thing I've seen like that is Mormonism. And then infinite and immaterial, that is an infinite being, an infinite thing, whatever, entity that is immaterial or spirit, and impersonal, that's basic monism, your Eastern concepts, Hinduism, Buddhism, that kind of thing. The idea that God is an infinite, impersonal force behind the universe. So an infinite but immaterial. It is non-material thing, but impersonal, not having intellect, emotions, and will. It's your basic Hinduism, Buddhism, that kind of thing. And then infinite and immaterial and personal is Yahweh, or the God of the Bible. That's the description that is given to him. Now, when we're talking with people about this, it's important to find out where a person is in his thinking so that you can direct him towards, how can I put it? What you want to do is find out where a person is in his thinking and show him that if he follows that thinking out to its conclusion, he's going to be in real trouble philosophically. Because if he follows the conclusions out, he'll see that it doesn't fit the real world that he's living in. And he doesn't live according to his philosophy. I was talking to a guy in the bar one time, and he was leaning against this tree holding on to his beer bottle. And he said, I'm a Buddhist. I think everything is an illusion. And I said, oh, really? I said, you're not leaning against that tree as if you think it's an illusion. And you're not holding that bottle in your hand as if you think it's an illusion. And when you go out of the bar tonight, you'll go out the door rather than going through the wall. Right? And he said, yes, I guess I will. Yeah. So when he went to leave that evening, he was walking out and I was following behind him. Mm-hmm. And he turned around, he started giggling. He said, what are you doing? I said, I'm following you to the door. He said, why? I said, to see if you go out the door, if you go out through the wall. And he said, I will go out through the door. And I said, yes, you will. Okay? Now, see, we as Christians get the opportunity to be hypocrites or not, because Christianity is livable, but we choose whether we will live it or not, whether we'll live consistently with what we say is the truth. We get the choice whether or not we're going to be hypocrites. Every other person that believes a different philosophy from Christianity has to be a hypocrite because they cannot consistently live their philosophy. So they will say one thing with their mouth and they'll do another thing with their lives. And what's that called? Hypocrisy. Okay? And so I tell people that and say, oh, there's so many hypocrites in the church. And I say, at least we get the choice of whether or not we're going to be hypocrites. You don't even get the choice. You have to be a hypocrite. No, they're not used to that kind of response. Right? I'm not used to having that turned around on them. I get the choice. I can choose whether or not I'm going to be a hypocrite. I can live differently than what I say is the truth. But because it's livable, or I can choose to live it. But you can't even live your philosophy. You say everything's an illusion. Just try to live like that. Why don't you stop eating food, since it's an illusion anyway? Why don't you start walking out in front of cars, since it's an illusion anyway? You see? Why do you drink water? Why do you sleep? It's all an illusion anyway. Why don't you stop all that? It's very time-consuming sleeping, you know. You could use that for working. But then, why should you work, since that's an illusion anyway? Why should you gain money, since that's an illusion too? You see, what good would that do you to have all of that illusion? Okay? And if pleasure is an illusion and pain is an illusion, what's the difference between having pleasure or pain? Doesn't make any difference. Doesn't make any difference whether you have a pleasurable experience or you stick your hand in a fire. Makes no difference. Okay? Why don't you start living consistently? They can't live consistently with their philosophy. And that'll be true of every philosophy other than Christianity, because there'll be some element where, some place where it will not fit the reality that people have to live in. Okay, so then, where were we? Yeah, people have to be hypocrites. What you want to do when you're using this chart and speaking to other people is you want to divide it off for them and show them why certain kinds of gods will not explain what's going on in the universe. So the first thing you do, and you'll notice I did this in three steps because there are three categories, right? The first thing I did is divided the chart like this, right? That is, you divide between the finite and the infinite. And so you can automatically eliminate four of the categories. If God were finite, that God would not be able to explain not only where everything else in the universe has come from, it will not be able to explain its own existence in the universe. Okay? Notice I got that under number one. If a God is finite or limited, it cannot explain the existence of all other finite things. For example, some people may think that idols, emperors, demons, or Haile Selassie are God, but these finite entities will not explain the existence of all other things. In fact, they cannot even explain their own existence. Thus, all finite gods are insufficient. You'd have to have an infinite, independent, non-contingent, absolute thing that started the universe in order to explain what's going on in the universe. Any finite thing has come from somewhere. Has come from somewhere because it has not always existed. If it has come from somewhere, then it itself cannot be God and has to have some other entity explain its existence. And so any finite God will not explain what's going on in the universe. So you've immediately eliminated four of your categories. You've chopped the chart in half. You only have four to explain now to show, could these explain what's going on in the universe? Okay, the next division is between the material and the immaterial. Okay, and that gives us two sets of two there. And under number two, I have, if a God is material in nature, it could not have existed forever. If it is material, entropy, the second law of thermodynamics, operates in its being. That means that it is always running downhill in its energy, or to put it another way, its being always moves towards greater and greater disorder. Now, if something has always existed, it should no longer have any order in its being, no matter how big it is, even infinite. Consequently, any infinite material God could not have always existed, is finite by definition, and requires the existence of some other God to explain its existence. Thus, any material God is an insufficient God. You get the idea? Anything that is material could not have always existed. So therefore, if it came into existence from some place, it is by definition finite rather than infinite. See? That's why I went infinite material question mark, you see? Because to have an infinite material thing cannot really happen. Actually, it ends up, you redefine, when you say infinite and then you say material, you automatically have redefined it to be a finite thing. Because material things must have come from somewhere. Because they don't have their own infinite existence. Okay, so you've eliminated the infinite material, you've eliminated material gods, that eliminates these two here. You've already eliminated these four because you eliminated finite. Then you divide the infinite into material and immaterial, and you eliminate these two, and that leaves you with only two left. And that is the infinite, material, and impersonal, or the infinite, did I say material? The infinite, immaterial, impersonal, or the infinite, immaterial, and personal. And then that brings us to step three. If a God is impersonal, not having intellect, emotions, and will, it cannot explain the presence of personality in the universe. If human beings came from an impersonal God, or even an infinite God, then this God made or brought forth something greater than itself. I was trying to avoid the word emanation, which is the typical Eastern concept there. It emanated a creation. Making something greater than itself would be physically impossible and philosophically illogical. Thus, an impersonal God is an insufficient God. Okay, and on the last page, if you take a look at the chart again and exclude the finite gods, okay, exclude the finite gods, right, and the material gods, right, and the impersonal gods, right, then you will see that there is only one possible God left. The infinite spiritual personal God. And that is exactly the kind of God who is presented in the Bible. I was outside an American military base, and I was outside the PX. Sort of it's their store, okay, on the American military base. And the post exchange. And I was talking to this guy who was high on LSD. which is rather interesting, trying to witness to somebody who is high on LSD. I don't know if you've ever done that before, but it is really interesting. You get some very strange responses at times from people who are on LSD. So I was talking to this guy, and he was sort of together in his mind, but every now and then he'd make these little weird responses. I won't try to figure out what happened in his head there. But I took out a chart, a piece of paper, and I drew this little chart for him. And I said, there are only 8 possible kinds of gods that there could be in the universe. And I went through this for him. We went through every one of these. We got over to here, and he went, okay. I said, infinite, immaterial, impersonal. I said, that's the kind of God I believe in, which I figured from the way he was talking, he was probably Hindu anyway. And so I said, that's basic Hinduism called monism. And he said, yeah, that's the kind of God I believe in. And then he said, he pointed to this. He said, but what's this? So what is this out here? And I said, that's the kind of God I believe in. And he said, that looks really interesting. I said, infinite, immaterial, and personal. And I said, yeah, that's the kind of God I believe in. That's the God of the Bible. And if you'd like to come down off of your drugs and maybe tomorrow or something come to see me at the coffee shop, I'd be glad to talk all this through with you. Well, he didn't come in. But a few months later, I was back at the castle in Germany, and I was leading a school for men from the American military bases that could come for 6 weeks and get what's called temporary duty, and they'd still be paid while they were going to this discipleship training school, which is rather an interesting thing that we were able to arrange. So they'd come for 6 weeks of discipleship training, and we would just like a mini DTS, and then they would actually be paid while they were there to go through that. It was rather, it was nice that they'd pay them, and may as well. Yeah, you never heard of that. So anyway, yeah, you've got to pay. Yeah, right. You got to pay here for your DTS. And while we were having our sort of get-together, know-each-other time, we were sharing our testimonies and stuff, as we were talking, there were about, I think, maybe like 10 guys in the school or something, we were sitting around in a group, and we were having an openness, brokenness time, and talking and giving testimonies, and this guy kept looking at me, and finally said, were you ever in Grafenwöhr? And I said, yes, that was where it happened. He said, were you ever in Grafenwöhr? And I said, yes, I was. I was there for a number of months. And he said, do you remember talking to a guy outside the post exchange about different kinds of gods? And I said, yes, as a matter of fact, I do remember that. And he said, I'm the guy. And evidently, in between there, in that period of 2 or 3 months, he had met some Christians and he'd gotten saved and then ended up coming into this discipleship training thing. You know, we don't always get to see the fruit of our witnessing. Very often you sow seeds and you water and you plant, you know, you weed and you plant, you do all kinds of things like that, but you don't get to see the fruit. In this case, I was able to see what had come out of that. And so I was happy to see that. But he finally got connected up with the right God, switched his concept there. Now, after you've dealt with the whole concept of what could God be like, then you need to give a further description of what this God, the God of the Bible, Yahweh, is like. And I want to take a brief look at the God of the Bible and look at some of his characteristics. There are characteristics that God has just because he is God, and we would call those his natural characteristics. He has them because of what his nature is like, not what his character is like, which you choose your character. You do not choose your nature. You understand the difference? You don't choose your nature, but you do choose your character, what your character is going to be like. So his natural characteristics or his natural attributes or qualities are things like this. Number one, God is eternal. The God of the Bible is an eternal God. He's always existed. That is not something that is to be explained. You cannot explain eternal existence. You can only stand there and look at it and go, wow. That's all you can do. As a matter of fact, if you try to think about it for long periods of time, your tubes will blow in your head and smoke will come out of your ears. And so you need to be careful not to blow the tubes in your brain trying to think about the eternal existence of God. The point is, something in the universe, if anything now exists, then something is eternal. Or something finite had to come from nothing.
And so the last idea, the idea that the universe just went bink into existence from nothing, is rather absurd, which it also redefines the word nothing to mean something from which something else could come. So you've redefined the word nothing to mean something, which in philosophy is called equivocation, changing the definitions of your words in the middle of your argument. Got that? Okay. Right. So the second possibility, the idea that the whole universe just went bink into existence from nothing, is patently absurd. Very few people have ever tried to argue that with me. Matter of fact, I don't think I've had anybody seriously try to argue that with me. Well, everything just went bink and came into existence from nothing. You don't find people like that. Then that means that something must be eternal. And it's either matter and energy, or it's a spirit being. God. It has to be material or immaterial. Okay? And so the idea that God is eternal is not something that you explain, but it does explain a lot of other things. Right? But it's not something that you try to explain to other people. You say either God is eternal, or that God could not be a sufficient God to explain what's going on in the universe if he's not eternal. If it came from someplace, or he came from someplace, then it's a finite God. And that will not explain what's going on in the universe. Therefore, God must be eternal. Now, when people ask you the question, where did God come from? It's a good question, but the point is, he didn't come from anywhere. He has always been. Okay? But it is a good question. So when people ask that question, don't tell them it's silly. It's a good question. Where did God come from? He didn't come from anywhere. He has always existed. But that's not the kind of thing you try to explain. You have to start with that kind of thought, or it will not explain anything else. Okay, the second thing is, God is spirit. Jesus said, God is spirit, and those that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. God is not material, and entropy does not operate in his being. The second law of thermodynamics does not operate in the spiritual realm, evidently. And so God, the Bible says, neither slumbers nor sleeps. Why is that? He who keeps Israel neither slumbers nor sleeps, because he doesn't need it. Right? When God created the world and he rested on the seventh day, what does it mean that he rested? Was he tired? No. All it means is that he stopped. That's what it means that he rested. And in Hebrews, in chapter 3, you can see that that's what it means, because it says, just as God ceased from his works, so we are to cease from our works in trying to be saved. This has nothing to do with being tired. You see the correlation that's being made there, the parallel? We need to stop trying to be saved by our good works and trust God's grace. Trust God that he will save us, right? And in the same way, God ceased from his works. By the way, he stopped on the seventh day, but he went back to work on the eighth, evidently. Because Jesus said, my Father has been working until now. God just didn't stop altogether. He stopped for the seventh day, but then he went back to work on the eighth. Evidently, because Jesus said, my Father has been working until now, and I also am working. Okay, so God is spirit, and entropy doesn't operate in his being. That means then that he can exist forever without ever reaching heat death or total entropy or steady state or whatever you want to call it from physics, because it just doesn't operate in the realm that he exists in, which is spirit. Okay, number three, God is personal. Notice these are qualities that God has as part of his nature. They're not something that God chooses. It's just part of the way God is, because he's the kind of being that he is. For instance, it's mostly black anyway. I have black hair. There's a lot of gray in there these days. But mostly black hair, right? And that's not something I chose. I didn't choose to have black hair. It's part of my nature. I didn't choose to have brown eyes. It's part of my nature. See? And God did not choose to be eternal. He didn't choose to be spirit. He didn't choose to be personal. That's just the way he's always been. It's part of his nature. He just is that. Okay? And so God is personal, which means that he has intellect, emotions, and will. God has a basic personality, and that means he is knowable. We can know him because he is a personal being. He has made us to be like himself. God is not like we are. We are like God is. He was there first. He made us to be like him in the image of God. Number four, God is three and one at the same time. Or if you want to put it in philosophical terms, God has unity and diversity in his being. There is only one God, and yet there are three persons in the being of God. That, again, is not the kind of thing that you explain, because it cannot be explained. It cannot be explained. For instance, have you noticed that God has never tried to explain in the Bible his eternity? It just states it. But can God explain that to us? No. It's just that you can conceive of the concept that something has always existed, but there's no way to explain that because it doesn't need explaining, right? It's just a matter of that's the way the universe is. God has always existed. You know? Okay? And then spirit. You ever notice that the Bible gives no definition of spirit? That's because spirit, as far as God is concerned, is the essential essence of what is. He is spirit. And so that's not something he tries to explain. It's just something that he is, right? God is personal. God has not tried to explain personality. The only thing we know about that is that that's exactly what makes us like God. That we are personal, and he is personal, and therefore we can know him. Okay? God is three in one is also not something that God tries to explain to us. It's just a fact of the being of God. He just is like that. Okay? And so God is three, and yet God is one. But this makes wonderful, wonderful philosophical sense when you're talking to people. It's just marvelous. And people will say, well, you know, can you explain the Trinity? No, but it sure explains a lot of what's going on in the universe. How is that? I can't explain unity and diversity in God, but it sure explains a lot of stuff about what's going on in the universe. See? For instance, in Christianity, we say that a God that has unity and diversity in his being brought forth a creation that has unity and on a finite scale, that has unity and diversity in its being. In other words, in my physical body, I've got my body, but then there are different parts to my body. My head, my hand, my foot. Now, I can point to my head and go, body, because the essential essence of this is body. I can point to my hand and go, body, because the essential essence is body. And I can point to my foot and go, body, because the essential essence is body. But my head is not my hand, and my hand is not my foot, and my foot is not my head. Which means what? I am in a system of unity and diversity. There is a unity about my body, and yet there's one body, and yet there are many members to the body. Paul the Apostle uses that kind of reasoning. And so we would expect, philosophically speaking, that if the whole universe is in complete systems of unity and diversity, we would expect then that God must at least have unity and diversity in his being. And so it makes perfect sense when the Bible reveals to us that God is one and yet God is three at the same time. Because if that were not so, we'd have to try to explain where the unity and diversity in the creation came from if it didn't come from God. You see? Because in Eastern religions, you've got this idea. A God with only unity in its being brought forth something greater than itself by bringing forth unity and diversity. Okay? That doesn't work philosophically speaking, because then you have the cause is less than the effect. That's why in Eastern religions, they're constantly trying to deny the diversity, because it doesn't fit in their system. You can get my tape on Eastern religions if you want a complete discussion of the denial of the diversity in the creation by people that are involved in Eastern religions. All right, but see, that doesn't work philosophically, because then you've got water running uphill or something personal coming from what is impersonal. The cause is less than the effect, and we never see that in the creation. Somebody once asked me, could God make a being like himself? Think about the question. Could God make a being like himself? If God made a being like himself, would it be like him? No, because it has not always existed. If he made a being, that being has not always existed. So it is finite, right? And so God could not make a being like himself, because the only thing that would be like God would be something that existed forever, has always existed, okay? So then, and it's really cute in Isaiah. For a few chapters there, God says, I can't find any other gods like me in the universe. Can you? Yeah, you want to take a look? I've looked, and I can't find any. Why don't you try taking a look? And see if you can find any gods like me. I don't know of any. Do you? Gets rather cute after a while there. Okay. Number five. God has power. He is powerful. Of course, that's most clearly exhibited through his ability to create. He's a creator. God is powerful. Boy, is he powerful. Think about the power of his word to be able to speak a word and all of the creation stood forth. The Bible says he spoke a word and it stood forth. The sun and moon and stars are just the work of his fingers. Imagine that. The heavens he can span with his hand. That's a span from there to there. That's how far it is across the universe, folks, for God. Isn't that amazing? Span of his hand. Woo! Okay. So God is powerful. God is powerful. He is a creator. He also has knowledge. He has always had knowledge. The Bible says, who showed to him the way of understanding? Obvious answer is nobody. Who taught him the path of knowledge? Wisdom. Isaiah 40, you can see a number of references there to his always or eternally having had understanding of morality, knowledge, wisdom. Certain facts were always present in his mind. Okay? So God has knowledge. Number 7, God has location. God has the ability to be everywhere, should he so choose. Now, I don't hold to the commonly accepted idea that God is absolutely everywhere all the time with no choice over the matter. I believe that God has the ability to be in a place or not be in a place, because the Bible talks about God's being in a place and not being in places and withdrawing his presence from places. Hell is everlasting destruction away from the presence of the Lord. And so forth. And so I, after reading through the entire Bible on this subject as to where is God, I found lots of references that didn't say what I had been taught in Bible school. You know, God is omnipresent. He's absolutely everywhere all the time. And I found references in the Bible that said that God wasn't in certain places or certain people. Whenever. Then God went up from the place where he spoke to Abraham. Then God said, let us go down there and confound their languages. God said, the outcry of Sodom and Gomorrah is indeed great, and their sin is exceedingly grave. I will go down now and find out if they've done all that I've heard they've done, and if not, I will know. That not only says that God wasn't in Sodom and Gomorrah, and he had to go down there to find out what was going on. It said he didn't even know, present tense, whether or not what he had heard was happening was so. Oh, my. Oh, my. Oh, my. Anyway, that's just a tickle of your brain. I spent 10 years studying that subject. You can spend a few years studying it. I wanted to find out how much does God know, so I spent 10 years studying it in the Bible. Changed my concept of God quite radically. All right. Number 7, God has location, and boy, can he have location. He can choose to be any place he wants to be, right? Now, we have spatial extension. We're extended in space. There's, my hand is not in the same place that my head is it? Is it? My hand in the same place my head is? So I'm extended into space. And God is also. The point is, though, that God can extend himself everywhere in space. You know, the Bible says the heavens of the heavens cannot contain him. Okay, that doesn't mean, though, that he doesn't have any control over his presence. It simply means that he's able to be everywhere when he wants to be. Okay? I don't think that's limiting to God whatsoever. I think the ability that he has ability to be someplace or not be someplace makes him a far greater being than if he had no choice in the matter. Don't you think? Yeah? And it also makes them a wonderful statement that God said, I will never leave you or forsake you. Means that he's making a choice to be with us all the time, makes it a wonderful promise. If God didn't have any choice in the matter, why should I be excited about a statement like, I will never leave you or forsake you, if he couldn't go anyplace anyway? No. Okay, anyway, location. Number 8, God has spatial extension. That's the point. God has control over that. That's a different matter. That would come under the whole area of moral attributes, what he does with his extension. Okay, and then number 8 is God is objective to his creation. The creation is not God, and God is not the creation. God is objective. He maintains objectivity
to his creation. Now we want to briefly, as we close here, want to look at some of the moral attributes of God, that is, qualities of character. These are qualities that God has because he chooses to have them. Okay? Now, properly understood, this first quality describes the rest of them, but they are laid out in different words for us in the Bible, so we're going to look at them. The first one is love. God chooses to love us. He chooses for our highest well-being with every choice that he makes. Every single choice that he makes towards us, and he makes all kinds of them every day, and every choice that he makes towards us is always for our well-being. So it means that he loves us. Now, properly understood, that word will encompass all of the rest of his character qualities. That's why the Bible says God is love. Okay? And uses the poetic hyperbole there. Okay. Now, the second thing is, God is holy. As I said, properly understood, if you understand love, it would also include holiness. Right? Because the highest well-being for us is for him to be holy. Understand? But what does it mean to be holy? It means to live up to the knowledge that you have of what is right and wrong. And God does that. In every choice that he makes, he does what he knows is right. And he commands us to live the same way. You shall therefore be holy. Right? For I am holy. Right? And the Bible in 1 Peter 1? Says that we are to be holy in all of our daily conduct. Daily behavior. It's something you choose to do. That when the Bible says God is holy, it's not talking about something God is, but something God chooses to do. Because it says you, like the Holy One who called you, is holy. You shall be holy in all of your daily behavior, your daily conduct, because he said, you shall be holy, for I am holy. It's something that God does, and it's something that we are also supposed to do. We are supposed to live up to the knowledge that we have of what is right and wrong. Isn't that wonderful? We don't have to live up to the knowledge that God has of what is right and wrong. That's his responsibility. Our responsibility is to live up to what we know of what is right and wrong. And we can do that. Okay, number three, God is completely just. Some versions will say righteous. What does that mean? That means he follows his law and he keeps his own law with respect to every moral being. He will treat every moral being completely fairly according to the law. And that means that if we do what is right, we'll be rewarded. If we do what is wrong, we're going to be punished. And that God will treat everybody exactly according to what is right. He's not going to make any exceptions. The Bible says there is no partiality with God. Number four, God is merciful. That means that God, although it would be proper for him to judge us and to condemn us for what we do when it's wrong, he still seeks a way to try to forgive us. He doesn't want to. This is also sometimes called loving kindness. He doesn't want to have to judge us, and so what he does is tries to express mercy towards us so that we can be forgiven. Number five, God is truthful. Although he has not told us everything he could have told us in his word, everything that he has told us is absolutely true, 100% true, even though he hasn't told us everything he could have told us. This is both wonderful and scary. It's wonderful in that you can trust God because he's going to be absolutely truthful. It's scary because if you ask him what your heart's like, he's going to tell you. And in love, of course, and in kindness, because he's kind in all his deeds. He's wise. That means he uses his knowledge to love people. The loving application of knowledge is what wisdom is. And so he uses the knowledge that he has to love others. And so he is wise. It's the loving application of knowledge. He's patient. This is one of the qualities I really appreciate. He is patient with us. The Greek word here means to go a long time before you burst into heavy breathing in anger. Makrothumia means you go a long time before you go. Okay? So he's patient. He's a God who is slow to anger. And lastly, he is faithful. That is, he's consistent. He's consistent in the way that he responds to us. He is always loving, holy, just, merciful, truthful, wise, patient. And that's what it means to be faithful. He will always be that way to us.